I'm Josh Cooperman, and this is Convo by Design. I am extremely excited to share this episode with you. I love doing the podcast, and because of that, I thoroughly enjoy every interview, tour, and conversation. This one was extremely laborious, but I have enjoyed every minute of it, and I really hope you like it as well. I recently toured the Neutra VDL Research House in Silver Lake, California. The property is not just a case study home, but it was the Neutra family home for decades, in two very different forms. The first home was designed by Richard Neutra in the 1930s, and the family lived in the international-style modern home for three decades. It burned down, and in the mid-1960s, it was completely reimagined by Neutra and his son, Dion. What rose from the ashes was a simply magnificent structure that fit the lifestyle of the family it was built for, like a custom-made glove. The lasting impact of Richard Neutra and his personal fit styling of architecture to embrace the occupant's lifestyle and thereby enhance the quality of life is evident in virtually every aspect of the design and materials that went into this home. A seemingly transparent glass box with complete privacy. Small spaces that feel huge, a miniature kitchen that contained all the modern conveniences of the day, and then some, like an elevator. This space is truly remarkable. I was given the grand tour by Sarah Lawrenson. Sarah is a professor in the architecture department at Cal Poly, owners of the property. She's the resident director of the Neutra VDL Showcase House and lives there full-time with her husband. Following is our conversation as we traverse through the many floors, rooms, and hallways of the home. Please check the Convo by Design YouTube channel and Instagram profile for videos and images from the home. We'll also be producing a room-by-room walking tour of the Richard Neutra VDL Research House, so go back often to check for updates. Thank you for listening. If you like what you hear, and I hope that you do, please go to ratings and reviews on iTunes, leave us a note and a positive review. Positive ratings help us attract new listeners to the podcast, and it's very much appreciated. Enjoy this episode of Convo by Design, presented by Snyder Diamond. Convo by Design, in our fifth season, and we've been presented by Snyder Diamond since episode number one. Snyder Diamond, always first with what's next in the kitchen and bath, is a relationship-based company. They're widely shopped and trusted by those in the business and homeowners alike because they have superior products and unmatched service. That's due to the people who work there, and it starts with second-generation president Russ Diamond. Russ travels extensively, looking for the brands that provide the latest in technology and design for the kitchen and bath. In the kitchen, smarter appliances mean you can create amazing dishes. These appliances provide you with the tools to do your best work and delight the entire family. Miele is a brand that provides a remarkable line of smart appliances like ovens with MasterChef and MasterChef Plus. These offer 100 easy-to-use programs that let you simply choose a setting or a special cooking mode and trust that your cakes, bread, or meats will be cooked to perfection automatically every time. Miele has everything you need for the kitchen of your dreams, and you can find details, the full line of Miele appliances, and that superior Snyder Diamond service at all three Los Angeles area Snyder Diamond showrooms. More information is also available at SnyderDiamond.com. Convo by Design with Sarah Lawrenson, and we are at the Richard Neutra VDL. What is the full title?
It has the house has a lot of different names. It's called the Neutra VDL Research House, or sometimes it's called just Neutra VDL, or sometimes it's called the Richard and Dion Neutra VDL House. Sometimes it's called the VDL Studio and Residences.
That's a lot of names.
It is. It depends sort of who's asking and what part of the property you're talking about, whether it's the entire compound or whether it's this particular house.
Well, and it's interesting too, because you talk about it being a residence. You live here.
Yes, I've been here. I've been living in the house for 10 years now.
And how did you come here? How did you wind up here?
So the house belongs to Cal Poly Pomona Foundation, but it's administered by the College of Environmental Design at Cal Poly Pomona, and I teach in the architecture department at Cal Poly Pomona, and basically there's always a professor who's sort of in charge of the house. I've been here longer than most, but yeah, and And in between that time, I was also the chair of the architecture department. So I've had a lot of hats.
You do have a lot of hats. How long have you been with Cal Poly Pomona?
I've been there since 2005.
And where do you come from originally?
So I'm from Mexico City. I grew up in Mexico City, and then I went to college in the U.S., in the Northeast at Smith, and in Atlanta at Atlanta College of Art and at Georgia Tech. And then I lived in San Francisco, and then I went to SciArc, so a lot of different places.
So in 10 years, you've certainly seen, I take that back. I wanted to say you've seen things change in the residence a great deal. But by the same token, you really haven't. This house, and we're going to tour it, we're going to walk around, and we're going to look, but this is very close to original.
Yes. Yeah. So the house was Richard Neuter's own house, and he built it, and we can talk about that a little bit later in various phases. But this house is from the current iteration is from 1965, and it was a collaboration between Dion and his father, Richard Neuter. And the house was given to Cal Poly in 1990, and because it went from the family directly to the university, there hasn't been any renovations or kind of changes or additions that were not respectful or kind of in keeping with the original house. So we really follow in the restoration of in work that we've done over the last 10 years. We really, you know, follow very strict, restoration protocols to make sure that everything that's original is kept, and anything that needs to be, you know, that's broken is fixed, but it's not necessarily replaced. So we sort of try to keep as much of the original material of the house as possible, while also ensuring that things that are not working or that are leaking get fixed. But the idea is that the house looks exactly the same, and all the fixtures are original, and all of the floors, everything that you see, the ceilings. People always ask, oh, you must have changed that. It's like, no, everything that you see was what was built originally in 1965.
And that is truly unique in, you know, especially in a city like Los Angeles, where things come down very quickly, you know, and oftentimes without people, sometimes without them knowing what it is they're taking down. How many completely original Neutras would you say, I mean, if you had to guess?
Oh, yeah, I don't know how much. He did about 300 projects in his lifetime. It's a very busy office. There have been a lot of projects destroyed. It's hard to say. You know, if I had to guess, maybe 20% were destroyed. There's still a lot of his work out there.
I remember a few years ago, so this had to be back in 2015, 2014, I was asked to go look at one of his projects in the Hollywood Hills that was owned by a Hollywood movie producer, and nobody had lived in the house for probably 15 years. And you could walk around and see all of the detail that was there, but you could also see amongst that the 3-inch piles of termite droppings. So it was this interesting dichotomy between beauty and just sort of something that's fallen by the wayside. Do you know how many projects Neutra did in the Los Angeles area?
Oh, you'd have to. I'm actually not a historian.
Yeah, no. I'm just curious.
But how many projects he did in L.A.? I mean, the bulk of his projects were in Southern California. So, I don't know, in L.A. there must be at least 100.
Well, I think it's interesting, too. So you talk about this project from 65. What was the impression that Neutra left on the architectural landscape of Southern California, specifically in Los Angeles? And I mention that because LA is such a city of fads. And I don't necessarily mean that in a bad way. I think one of the really exciting parts about Los Angeles is this willingness to experiment.
Yeah.
And a climate that's conducive to that, and a culture that embraces new and different and something like this. So I'm curious the lasting effect that you feel the architectural style had on the architectural landscape of Los Angeles.
Well, I think primarily it's what you're talking about, this idea of kind of reinvention and the idea of the new and kind of building things that are kind of unexpected and have a different set of ideals behind them. And I think that that spirit is certainly, you know, one of the lasting legacies of Neutra and Schindler and, you know, Lautner, who really came here and sort of did these radically new houses. And I would say that is, as an architect, I'm a designer also, and really the idea of doing something that is of its time is definitely kind of one of the, in terms of a philosophy, I think is incredibly important to Southern California, and certainly these people are still of interest, not only because of the beauty of their own work, but really the kind of the goal of building something that is contemporary and that is reflective of the era, the technology, the ideas about new ways of living, about the way that the family structures are changing and how you would kind of adapt a house, you know, new building practices. Aesthetically, there obviously is still a very strong legacy of this kind of modernism that we see still people being very interested in, the kind of aesthetic of modern mid-century modernism. But I think more importantly was that the goal of building something that was new.
And it's interesting you mentioned Schindler. The relationship between Rudolf Schindler and Richard Neutra, they were friends, yet how hard do you think they pushed each other?
Well, they were friends, very close friends early on, and really Neutra came here in large part because Schindler was established here. And they lived together at the King's Roadhouse for 4 years, and they had a collaborative practice that they worked together. That relationship ended in the, you know, 29-30, you know, for various reasons. But I think they were always very aware of each other's work, and certainly they both had similar values about sort of using their houses as places to talk to people from the outside and having these salons and sort of creating a culture of conversation about design. And I think they obviously were both very interested in not just, you know, having their own work built and seen, but also in the conversation about contemporary design and other issues, politics and aesthetics and music.
And it's interesting too, because one of the things that you notice, so we're on the first floor of the house, and you enter into a very social room. The footprint of this property, and we were talking a little earlier, and we're going to see some examples of this. It feels very nautical, insofar as the stairwells are narrow, and the rooms are small, and the furniture, how it's built in, it reminds you of a submarine or a ship, you know, that you're living in. The use of space, it's almost like there was no expense spared for the social areas, yet the living area is very compact and tight. What was the theory? Do I have that right? Is that kind of like the theory behind it?
Absolutely. It was, well, there was a few things. One of it is kind of maximum flexibility of a space, you know, in the same way that, let's say, a traditional Japanese house can be reconfigured many different ways for different uses. And this ground floor that we're looking at was, you know, at times it was his office, at other times they used it for events, but it is a kind of quasi-public space, so that the ground floor is given up to a kind of, you know, public sphere where you would have conversations and you could have, you know, lectures and music recitals, and the flexibility of the space to be able to be reconfigured for many different uses was very important. And the same thing with kind of minimizing waste and kind of packing everything in tightly, you know, having, allowing for, you know, the, if the furniture is built in, that means that you have a kind of flexible open space to reconfigure it. And it's also about a kind of total, what they call total design, where you're really designing all components of the house, not just the container, but you're also designing the furniture, and you're also kind of thinking about, you know, all of the storage and all the ways that you might, you know, all of the parts of domesticity, not just the container, which then gets filled with objects, which is a little bit more how we design today.
And it's interesting, what do you think, what was the reason behind moving away from that? You know, the, Frank Lloyd Wright, very similar in the approach where you have the architecture, you have the residence, and then you have furniture that's built in to match that, accentuate that on a different scale. We've gotten away from that, but that was the goal, wasn't it, to have something that was totally self-contained?
Right. Well, I mean, the positive side of that is that there's a kind of a real consideration for all parts of living, you know, from the furniture to the dishes to the clothing. The side that was the negative side of that, and the part that was rejected, I'd say, with postmodernism, was this kind of the totality of it, that it was felt to be oppressive in a way that the individual voices of people and the way that we collect things and the kind of eccentricities of what we do were somehow it was made harder for people if you had designed everything, right? There's these quotes about, you know, the slippers of, I think that was Frank Lloyd Wright, that the slippers don't meet the aesthetic of the or maybe that was Neutra, I can't remember, it was one or the other, that the slippers of the owner didn't meet the aesthetic of the house and that they needed to get rid of their slippers. It's a little bit of a joke, right, about how the kind of totality of the master architect that sort of designed every aspect of your life. And there's even some people in kind of more contemporary designers, but who had that philosophy, like a great designer in the South, Ain. And he had the same thing. He designed the wedding dress for the woman so that there was a kind of complete aesthetic for this wedding that took place at her house, and that you could see why people would sort of bristle a little bit at that when there was a kind of rejection of that kind of where everything, the kind of totalizing view of the world that could be kind of sort of that it was limiting in some way.
And I think that the limiting, the nature of that is that it limits the personality and it limits your ability to personalize something. And I kind of gather that was one of the underlying tenets of Neutra's philosophy, his architectural philosophy, was, you know, personalization is not in his repertoire. He's gonna make it exactly like he wants you to have it.
Yeah, I'm probably saying things that are conflicting, because on the one hand, we look at the buildings and they all seem fairly similar. There's a kind of kit of parts. There's certainly they're recognizable as an aesthetic where you sort of see features repeated and ways of dealing with the cladding or the windows are similar. But he also was very interested in the particularities of how that one family lived. So he would have these extensive questionnaires that were given to the family that was about every aspect of their life for them to explain so that it could be kind of tailor-made for that particular family. You know, that the way that they lived or their social relationships, their health, their, like, everything about how they lived so that the house would be kind of designed with a very particular client in mind.
Don't you find that interesting, though, that so much work would be put into how the client lives. As people, we change so quickly and so often, yet to build an entire residence around the way that a certain family might live at the time, I find that really interesting. Did he account for growth and change and development?
Well, you certainly see it here. It's what I was bringing up before, that there is, on the one hand, this very kind of this interest in the particular, but then there is also this interest in a kind of flexible space that could be transformed over time. So it's a little bit hard to sort of figure out which parts of it are, which aspects of it are very kind of totalizing and they're very kind of contained in particular to that family. But then there's also this idea about kind of allowing for different uses and transformation and kind of flexibility of a family changing. Certainly in this house, it's very funny that you say that. It's because we have these tours of the house every Saturday that we train students to kind of tell people about how the house was used and, you know, the architectural tenants of the house and Neutra and his history. And in order to make it simpler to tell the story, we kind of say this space was used for this and, the, you know, he lived here and the wife slept here and the kids slept here. But the reality is that they were always moving. So there wasn't, like, they sometimes slept in the other house or sometimes in different periods of their life there might have been, the kids might have been in, like, Raymond had a room in the, Richard's youngest son had a room in the basement that he slept in. And then other times, you know, sister-in-law was here. And so I think they were aware of this changing, you know, that families change over time and that different, there isn't a kind of singular story. And we face that right now in terms of how we tell the story about this house. And sometimes you take shortcuts to make it easier to understand, you know, what the major issues are, but they're always kind of, there's always a kind of exact conflicting point of view that is sometimes not talked about in order to make the story simpler.
That makes sense. All right, we're going to go, we're going to walk around. This is a really good example. We've just gone inside to outside. This space, I mean, obviously we were talking before, the codes and restrictions for railings, and obviously that was non-existent at the time, but this space just works so well. So this is probably the most remarkable view you can have of the reservoir.
Yeah, so this space up on the penthouse, it's basically a glass room that was really a space for events or for, you know, parties or something, that social spaces that would then, but then also Dione would use it to play her cello. So she worked up here and she was his wife, Richard Neutra's wife, Dione, was a musician. So she would use it to play the cello. But it does create this, you know, this great use of, we were talking about ways to get additional exterior space on a property. And this is a rooftop terrace, which is allowed. The railings would have to be a little bit higher, like, But you can certainly use other spaces in the house. What's remarkable about this property is that every single room in the house has a direct access to the outdoors. So whether you're in a bedroom, a living room, the kitchen, the kind of this glass pavilion, you can always walk straight outside and then have this view of either, you know, a private courtyard or this spectacular view of the reservoir.
And the penthouse, what do you imagine the thought process was behind the space? Because you have this great outdoor space here. Inside, you have the narrow stairwell that goes up, and you show me how the flaps fold down, and there is a small, it's basically a floor level sofa
seating area
for looking out at the reservoir. Was this sort of the Zen going to find your peace? Is that the purpose?
Today it would be a yoga studio.
Right. Oh, it totally would.
But I think it was. It was also the idea of having the furniture so low was that your eye, again, it's about controlling kind of what you see. So when you're sitting so low, you don't see the road. The road basically goes away. And there's where the rocks are in front of the penthouse, that all gets filled with water. We still do it during events. We don't have it filled right now, but whenever we have an event, we usually fill that. And it basically gets about 1 inch of water over the roof. And so when you were sitting low, you would see the water of the roof and then the water of the reservoir. It's a bit like an infinity pool today, right? Where there's a kind of seamless edge. And then you see the water beyond of the reservoir, like you would in a hotel with the infinity pool and the ocean. So it brings those two bodies of water together. Noitra had this idea of a kind of connecting the landscape and the foreground and the background and a kind of landscape feature outside and something that was happening inside and finding ways to connect them either by creating a particular view or having a material that connected the two interior and exterior conditions so that you really, and also sort of dematerializing the house so that the house sort of goes away and that you really feel like you're kind of outside and connected to, you know, you really felt that this was a way to improve your health too, a kind of your mental and physiological health by having these spaces where you could feel, you know, connected to a landscape.
Well, and it's interesting too because there's a lot of research now to sort of support that theory. And in addition to that, you can also see by filling in a 2 to 3 inch water feature, how he really did sort of use every inch of the property for a very particular purpose and for a reason.
Right.
Yeah. So let's flip around now because I want to show the other view. There you go. So again, simply remarkable use of space. He could have very easily continued the penthouse over to the edge of the dwelling, but found again, and behind you there's another space that can be filled in with water. So you're almost, at some point, you're almost entirely surrounded by water when you're in the penthouse.
Right, and maybe it goes back to your analogy of this as a ship, a sort of floating pavilion on the water. So we see the St. Gabriel Mountains behind us, and on the ground, on the living room floor also, you'll see when we go back down, there's these high windows that perfectly frame the St. Gabriel Mountains, almost like a painting. Right, and one of the things you'll notice, there's not a lot of wall space throughout the house. So there's not a lot of places to hang artwork but the landscape and the views become a kind of artwork, right? You have these very particularly framed views that become, and certainly the St. Gabriels are one of them. That's sort of one of the really amazing features that you see from here.
It's interesting, what I'm thinking about now is what you're talking about. The house is surrounded by glass. What you mentioned was that there isn't a lot of wall space. So in the 60s, mid-60s, when this house is built, television is exploding across the U.S. And TV is the center point socially. For the family, you have designated watching times, and this is before TVs are hung on the wall, for sure. But Neutra left no space for a big boxy TV, none.
Yeah, I never thought about that. That there isn't any kind of a room that is purely about a kind of internal life. It's the life is always connected to the outdoors, either the outdoors or to a kind of more social life. You know, that it's always a kind of outward looking space versus maybe a kind of something that we're contained within.
Well, and to your point, between the St. Gabriel's behind you and the reservoir on the other side of you, and walls and walls of glass, that was the entertainment.
Right.
It's interesting. We are in, whose bedroom was this?
This was Dione Neutra's bedroom, okay. At least, right. In this house. In the first house, I think it was one of the children's bedrooms, but yeah.
Okay, so this is, and again, you know, I'm reminded of the nautical theme. This looks like a small stateroom.
Yeah.
On a ship.
A ship's cabin, absolutely. I mean, it is very small. It's about 10 feet by 9 feet, so much smaller than most bedrooms. But it has an enormous amount of storage space, and it has all the things you need. It's got a great view of the reservoir, which is behind you. And then it's got a door to the patio, so you can always, like I said, you can always go outside. And then it's got storage, all of these drawers under the bed. The bed can actually swing out, so you can make the bed without having to kind of jump over it. And then there's a desk and a closet, shelves.
So is the bed on a pivot?
Yeah.
The bed's on a pivot. Brilliant. Brilliant. Very smart.
If you're going to put a bed against the corner, that's the only way to do it.
It really is, isn't it? And again, so the furniture is built in. It's got a ton of storage, drawers on the front, a cabinet on the bottom, shelving above, small desk to the side. So it's a small space, but every inch is being used.
Yeah, and like you said, if you know the private spaces, the bedrooms, if you're really using them mainly to sleep, that allows to have kind of the other parts of the house be a lot more open and large. But there's also so many exterior little spaces, patios and balconies, that even though there was a lot of people living here, right, because it's, especially in the first house, there was like an office downstairs with 7 draftsmen and a maid and the sister-in-law and 3 kids and the parents, and there was a guest room, and then there was a little apartment for his apprentices. So you could have had 30 people on this property, that you do need spaces to get away. So I think the kind of breaking up of all of these little exterior balconies off of every room does make even a very compact space much more livable.
And apartments for apprentices. So was work done primarily here at the time?
Until the 1950s, when they moved the office over to Glendale.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. This is great. And then again, outside, you have...
Oh, yeah, that's a reflecting pool, too. So you'd have the water outside of your bedroom, and then you'd see the water beyond, which is great. If you're lying in bed, you see a pool of water at your feet, and then beyond that, the pool of the reservoir.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Great use of space. Oh, you know what? The last thing I was gonna ask you about is the ceilings. To your point earlier about materials and industrial.
Off the shelf, yeah, acoustical tile. You don't typically see that in residential construction. Most of the materials are kind of used and would be more traditional to commercial construction.
So, but are the ceiling? It's acoustical tile. Like downstairs, I saw popcorn, which for the time was completely normal. But so are the ceilings dropped?
This is the utilities are running through here. So there's the HVAC system, the heating, cooling is running there, which is why this is dropped. It's basically a spine, an infrastructural spine that runs all the air through the house.
And so to get to it, you're not coming from an attic down, you're coming from the ceiling tiles up.
Right, right. You can just access the mechanical equipment right there.
How easy is that?
That's good.
So smart.
It also does this thing where it basically, you enter a room, it's a kind of Frank Lloyd Wright trick, right? That you enter a room and you have a very low height, which then means that when you open up the ceiling height at the edges, it makes it feel a lot more spacious, right? It's this compress and release that a lot of architects use.
As an architect, what's your philosophy on that, your thought on that?
It's an incredibly effective way of kind of Well, I think having the spaces change and the heights change according to kind of taking you through a house, and you're in a small space and then you're in a larger space, it makes the large space even bigger. It's a very effective tool. We certainly use it.
Interesting. Are there any other techniques that were used in the house that you can recognize easily, like that are used to sort of make the space more expansive?
Well, certainly the mirrors, which would kind of double the size of the space. I think also not having framing around things, like the doors don't have, you know, a standard door would have a door frame. If you eliminate the door frame and you do these blind frames, then the house, basically the planar aspects of the house are much more legible, but it also makes the house feel much more open, you know, because you don't have these kind of interruptions of all of this kind of little changes in surfaces that are constantly happening, which make the walls much more busy. It feels a lot lighter and a lot more open.
Yeah. Thanks for pointing that out. I hadn't noticed that. That's really cool. This is Neutra's bedroom.
So this was Richard Neutra's bedroom. Again, not a very large room, but it does have all of the components that you'd see, a desk, a very large balcony that he could go and look out into the courtyard. And then one of the funny things is that you'll see, I don't know, next to the bed, he had all of this gadgetry, right? Because he's got a phone, because he actually worked in bed a lot. So he had a drafting table that could go over the bed. And he had a microphone set where he could talk and give instructions. But when his office was downstairs, he could also use the telecom to kind of yell instructions down to the studio below. And it has, like, he can control all the lights of the house, the louvers. So you could close the louvers, which are outside. It's a little bit hard to see because this is a kind of reflective glass, so that it also gives privacy. But I like that there's a kind of a command center in the bedroom.
This really is a command center from the bed. That's fascinating. And you know what's interesting, too, is so his wife's bedroom was next door, and she had a view over the reservoir with a reflecting pool there. His bed faces the other direction.
The other direction has a large balcony and looks into the courtyard.
Yeah, and so it's a completely different experience.
Absolutely.
Two rooms right next to each other with completely different experience. And interesting. So this really is the command. He's got the desk, but it sounds like he didn't use the desk often. He worked from bed. Who wouldn't want to do that?
Right.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Work in your PJs.
Totally. Oh, that's great. All right. Richard Neutra's bedroom. Okay. Final stop, outside courtyard. And you were mentioning, and it's funny, another reflecting pool, and you were mentioning that Dione and Richard Neutra's, this is their final resting place.
Right. Their ashes are here.
That makes sense. This really was home for them.
For a very long time. So Richard Neutra was here and Dione from 1932. Richard Neutra died in 1970, and then his wife Dione lived here until 1990. They spent most of their life here.
So interesting too, as we were walking down, it's funny, it was an experience that you just sort of passed off as it happens every day. It was a little startling for me, but I looked over to the right through the glass door, and there's a nice looking woman standing there with her dog, waving as though she knew you. Clearly she doesn't. And you mentioned that you know, this happens all the time. People just stop by this place all the time. I'm wondering if it was the same for Dione after Richard had passed on, and she lived here for, you know, 20 more years, and then you live on premises, so that happens to you quite a bit. And then I was gonna ask you sort of how the property is used now.
Yeah, so now, about 10 years ago, we started these tours that we have every Saturday, so anybody can come here. They're drop-in tours, 11 to 3. It's an opportunity for students to learn about the life of Neutra, and they do their own tour. So obviously I check them, but they're all a little bit different, and it's a great way to interact with the public. The house is primarily an educational space for the school, and obviously I live here too, but then we also want to have it as a kind of cultural center, and also to have it as a space to talk about architecture and about, you know, about the relationship of... There's a lot of airplanes in LA. It's always LA, the helicopters. So we have this... We use the house for, you know, we open the house for tours. We have it for events. We have discussions, and we have music recitals and poetry readings and performances. And then once a year, we have an artist in residence, which is up for about 3 months. And they're allowed to live. They live here, and then they transform the house in some way. We don't do exhibitions. These are all kind of responses by artists to the space. So they have to be site-specific. And we've done that since about 2010. They're always very interesting. They're kind of dramatically change the house sometimes, or sometimes they're a little bit more subtle. We're doing one with a German group called Bless, who's in Paris and Berlin next summer. But we've done exhibitions with French artists or installations by French artists, people from Mexico, LA, different groups.
So what types of work do they do, and then does the work remain?
No, it's all in situ, it's all temporary, and it's non-commercial. So it's basically like we had a Swiss artist here, Gregory Shep, we saw, and he built this almost like a Burning Man sculpture that was like in the center of this courtyard. It went up 45 feet, and it had all these passageways that you could climb it, and you could go all the way to the top and look over the building into the, and that was up for about 2 months. It was all, and that was, it obviously that radically changed the house, because this whole space was basically this cacophony of wood that you could climb, and there was seating areas that you could... It was very cool. It's like the coolest treehouse ever. So that one was one kind of intervention. We've had other ones. We had one with the Vende Museum, which is in Culver City, where we took out all of the objects from the house and replaced them from similar objects from East Germany from the same period, from their collection. It's a little bit of like Alice Through the Looking Glass, you know, that it was... Everything was the same, but it was also completely different because, you know, and it was a kind of one-to-one relationship. So you'd have a pot, you know, a vase that was from Dione, and it was an equivalent vase from East Germany in the furniture. That was very successful as an exhibition because it kind of made you think about the role of utopia and modernism and East-West. I don't know, we've had a lot of different exhibitions. We try to not do it more than 3 months so that the experience, most people want to come here and see the house as it was. So we want to make the house available to people to see the way that it was originally. But it's a way of also bringing in other kinds of audiences, local artists and architects, to kind of talk about kind of the right. A house like this has to have another, because there's not a family living here. It has to have another reason to be, otherwise it kind of loses its you know, its character, or it doesn't have a It has to be occupied by something. It's not a work of art. It's a building. It should have life in it. So we have to fill it with some form of life and experiences.
Interesting. So it has to have some life form, life source, some energy. And so...
otherwise it's kind of sad when you see a house that's just a kind of, right, a monument to something and nobody's using it. I find that, you know, houses are most, the experience that you have, you know, of a house is also about the way that it's used. It's not just about what it looks like.
Yeah, it's not a museum. This is not a museum.
No, it's not a museum. Actually, and I always tell people that it's not a, there are house museums which are about kind of freezing things in time. This is really a house where we live, but also a cultural space and also educational space, an art space, a space of discussion.
So you mentioned that Richard Neutra had worked on 300 projects during the course of his career. Vast majority in the Los Angeles area, fair to say?
Yeah, I would say in Southern California.
What is the legacy? What is Richard Neutra's legacy, and where does he fit in the architectural pantheon for Southern California? Where does he fit? What is the legacy? What is the lasting effect with regard to how he is remembered and how his work affects Southern California architecture moving forward?
I think there's a lot of things that we can take from this, and that people are so interested in coming here are, you know, architects primarily, but also people interested in design. And it has to do with kind of designing with economy, which I think is an issue that we're still very interested in, about this issue of kind of high density, of how do you make something feel really kind of gracious and livable, but also have a lot of different, you know, maximize the space we have in a way that's very artful. I think it's also about kind of an aesthetic, which is really a kind of consideration of how you see from the space out, and then how you see what the building looks like. So certainly there's a lot of, you know, things that we can learn from the way that it was put together so artfully, and kind of to really kind of reinforce these ideas of these planar operations and these ways of kind of constructing a space. I would say that those are the main things that I would take from it, that I take from it as an architect.
Well, I want to thank you for taking the time and sharing, first and foremost, for the information and the perspective, because this was really fascinating. This was really enjoyable. This was great. And the second part is to thank you, because this isn't just work. This is also your home. And so taking us in and showing us around and sharing, it was really great. Sarah Lawrence, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Sarah Lawrenson at the Neutra VDL Research House. If you have a chance to tour the Silver Lake home, I recommend it highly. If you can't get down there, go to the Convo by Design YouTube channel or our Instagram or Twitter to see images and videos from our walkthrough. Convo by Design is proud to be working with Vendome Furniture. Design culture, it's the key to their success. It's what pushes them to consistently create new collections that give spaces a new dimension. They create dialogue between environment and form. Vendome pieces can transform the simplest space into one filled with glamour that's both unique and extraordinary. And isn't that what design is all about? Creating atmospheres where you can take hold of life and enjoy it to the fullest. Vendome products are simple and elegant, contemporary and exceptionally comfortable. Their crafted, modern, durable, molded resin, glass, and metal designs are unique, and they beg to be enjoyed. They search the planet for the right designers that embody the Vandam spirit and work together to create remarkable pieces into an exclusively Vandam mode of expression. You can find Vandam in their showrooms at the D&D Building in New York, Wynwood in Miami, and the Pacific Design Center in Los Angeles, or online at vandam.com.